3,951. Active, 605. Midland County, 3,551 confirmed cases with 81 deaths. From the Texas Tribune, Texas approaching 15,000 coronavirus deaths as cases, hospitalizations decline from July's record highs. 3,132 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of September 21st, 193 less than a week ago. They occupy 5.5% of hospital beds. 1,742 new cases were reported on September 21st. The latest positivity rate is 6.64%. 14,917 Texans have died as of September 21st. 24 more deaths reported than the day before and 706 more than a week ago. West Texas Intermediate today is trading at $39.45. That is up 15 cents. And now we'll bring you coronavirus briefs and a few short articles. President Trump falsely claimed at a Monday night campaign rally that the coronavirus affects virtually nobody below the age of 18 and is mainly a risk to elderly people with heart problems and other pre-existing conditions. In a March 19th interview with Washington Post associate editor Bob Woodward, however, Trump acknowledged that plenty of young people were affected and admitted that he had downplayed the risk of the virus. As of today, 200,000 people in the United States have died of the coronavirus since February. At least 6.8 million cases have been reported. A $1 billion fund Congress gave the Pentagon in March to build up the country's supplies of medical equipment has instead been mostly funded to defense contractors and used for making things such as jet engine parts, body armor, and dress uniforms. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on Monday removed language from its website that said the coronavirus spreads via airborne transmission, the latest example of the agency backtracking from its own guidance. Many experts remain adamant that the virus is airborne. We'll have more on that in a moment. A communication staffer at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases abruptly announced plans to retire Monday after the Daily Beast revealed that he savaged his top boss, Anthony S. Fauci, in anonymous editorials on conservative website redstate.com. Let's move to short articles. We have a few that reflect an interview with Dr. Anthony Fauci from earlier today. The first is, people at any age with underlying conditions are in the risk group for serious disease, Fauci says. It isn't just the elderly who are at risk of serious illness when infected with the novel coronavirus. Younger people with underlying conditions are also in that high-risk category. Dr. Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, told CNN's Dr. Sanjay Gupta during the Citizen by CNN event on Tuesday. It isn't just the elderly and those with underlying conditions, Fauci said, because it can be serious in young people. Quantitatively, for sure, it's much less serious as a group in young people, he said. But it is important to remember that there are many people in all age groups who have underlying conditions. And if you look at the two groups that are at risk for serious conditions, it's the elderly and people at any age with underlying conditions, he said, underlining any age. If you're a person younger with an underlying condition such as diabetes, obesity, hypertension, or heart disease, you are in the risk category for serious disease, he said. The people with underlying conditions make up a substantial portion of the population, Fauci said. So don't think it's just the elderly that are the problem, he said. True, people with underlying conditions, but those are not just isolated to the elderly. There are plenty of younger people who have underlying conditions that put them at risk. Fauci's comments came a day after President Trump falsely claimed the virus affects nobody young. We know the disease. We didn't know it. Now we know it. It affects elderly people with heart problems and other problems. If they have other problems, that's what it really affects. In some states, it affects thousands of people. Nobody young. Below the age of 18, like nobody, Trump said at a rally in Swanton, Ohio, last night. Now, here's another related article to that interview. Fauci says aerosol transmission of COVID-19 doesn't change anything we've been saying. Dr. Fauci told CNN's Dr. Sanjay Gupta during the Citizen by CNN event on Tuesday that you can assume aerosols are a component of COVID-19 transmission, and while the amount they contribute to the spread isn't yet known, it doesn't change what has been said. When you look at what's going on and the evidence that we've seen so far, you can assume that a component, and we don't know, and here's where you've got to be humble enough and honest enough, that we don't know the extent to which the aerosol component is contributing to transmission, Fauci said. You can make a reasonable assumption, Sanjay, that some aspect of the transmission can be and is by aerosol, he said. The interesting thing about that, it doesn't change anything that we've been saying. It means wear your mask. It means avoid close contact. It means avoid crowds. And it means what we've been saying. The third or fourth thing that I mentioned to you just a little while ago is that outdoors is better than indoors, he said, because if there is aerosol indoors, there can be some recirculation. Fauci said there have been some case reports of situations in places such as restaurants where it looks like it almost had to be an aerosol spread. Remember, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention abruptly reverted to its previous guidance about how coronavirus is transmitted after saying on Friday that the virus can spread through the air. And now here's the third and final story from that interview. Fauci says officials aren't changing their minds on guidance. The science is evolving. Dr. Fauci said COVID-19 is an evolving outbreak and it needs to be led by using scientific data. Speaking to Sanjay Gupta, Fauci said, "The public needs to understand is that it is an evolving situation." Fauci said a classic example of this is back in the spring when officials altered mask guidance. "We were not aware that 40% to 45% of people were asymptomatic, nor were we aware that a substantial proportion of people who get infected from people who are without symptoms. That makes it overwhelmingly important for everyone to wear a mask," Fauci said. So when people say, "Well, why did you change your stance?" and "Why are you emphasizing masks so much now when back then you didn't?" and "In fact, you even said you shouldn't wear one because there was a shortage of masks." Well, the data now are very, very clear, he added. "We need to put that nonsense behind us about, well, they keep changing their minds. Masks works. Physical distancing works. Avoiding crowds work," Fauci said. In Texas, the burden of coronavirus on Latinos is diverse and underestimated. The coronavirus is devastating Latino communities across the country, from California's Imperial Valley to suburban Boston and Puerto Rico. Workers at Midwestern meatpacking plants and on construction sites in Florida are getting sick and dying of a virus that is exacerbating historic inequalities in communities where residents, many of whom are essential workers, struggle to access health care. The undocumented are largely invisible. Latinos, who are not a racial group and come from diverse backgrounds, make up an increasing portion of deaths from COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus. More than 36,500 Latinos have died of the virus, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, analyzed by the Washington Post. If you look at all the negative factors, risky jobs or unemployment, unsafe housing, poor air quality, and pre-existing conditions, it's all people of color, says Carlos E. Rodriguez Diaz, an associate professor at the Milken Institute of Public Health at George Washington University. Having both flu and COVID-19 doubles risk of death, British scientists find. People suffering from influenza and COVID-19 simultaneously face a significantly higher risk of death, British government scientists warned Tuesday following a new study conducted during the early months of the global health crisis. England's deputy chief medical officer, Jonathan Van Tam, said that 43% of patients who had been hospitalized with both infections died, compared with 26.9% of people who were admitted to the hospital and tested positive for the coronavirus only. The research indicates that those suffering from co-infection of flu and COVID-19 were 2.27 times more likely to die than those who had tested positive for the coronavirus. Van Tam noted that while the study, conducted between January and April, was based on a small number of subjects, 58 people, the findings aligned with other investigations being carried out. He added that more research was underway. If you get both, you are in some serious trouble, and the people who are most likely to get both of these infections may be the very people who can least afford to in terms of their own immune system or their risk for serious outcomes, said Yvonne Doyle, Public Health England's medical director. She urged people considered high risk to get a flu shot. Halloween activities such as trick-or-treating and costume masks discouraged by the U.S. CDC this year. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, has issued its first guidance for the holidays, including Halloween, while the coronavirus pandemic rages on. Most traditional activities for Halloween, such as door-to-door trick-or-treating and costume parties, are discouraged this year due to the pandemic, the CDC said in a new posting on its website. The new guidance lists low-risk, moderate, and higher-risk activities for celebrating All Hallows' Eve. Low-risk activities include carving pumpkins and decorating your home, outdoor scavenger hunts, virtual costume contests, and hosting a movie night with household members. Moderate-risk things to do include so-called one-way trick-or-treating by exchanging goodie bags placed at the end of a driveway or the edge of a yard, having a very small group outside for an open-air costume parade where participants are at least 6 feet apart, or attending an outdoor costume party where masks are worn and people social distance. Higher-risk activities the CDC is urging against include door-to-door trick-or-treating, attending crowded indoor costume parties, visiting indoor haunted houses, or going on hay rides or tractor rides with strangers. The agency is also discouraging the use of costume masks this year, saying they are not a substitute for cloth masks. It is also warning against wearing a costume mask over a protective cloth, pointing out it's dangerous because it might make it hard to breathe. Now for the remainder of our time today, we're going to bring you some pre-recorded reports, most of which are related to the medical aspects of the pandemic. And then as we have time today, toward the end of the program, we're going to bring you a few reports about caring for the elderly, as well as a report about Texas elder care visitation rules that have been relaxed. First, we'll begin with this from NPR. CDC criticized for posting COVID-19 guidance and then withdrawing it.
What should we make of what the CDC said and then unsaid? On Friday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention published new guidance. It said the coronavirus is airborne. That does not refer to the little droplets that travel a few feet from an infected person. To scientists, airborne means the virus may travel considerable distances, and aerosol transmission might be one of the most common ways that it spreads. The guidance was up all weekend and then removed on Monday. The agency says this was a draft posted in error. Dr. Ali Khan is here to talk with us about this. He's a former CDC official, now the dean of the College of Public Health at the University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha. He's on Skype. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you.
And welcome back to the program. Wasn't it already widely understood that there was airborne transmission?
Yes, Steve, absolutely. So there's nothing new in this change in guidance that there's a minor role for airborne transmission. And we knew this from SARS coronavirus 1, and we now have additional data from this new SARS coronavirus 2. So the disease is predominantly large particle aerosol. So that's why this is predominantly aerosol. So this is somebody standing in front of you who's coughing, speaking, sneezing, singing, for example, is the major mode of transmission. Occasionally, we get this disease from contaminated surfaces. And then there's a minor role, again, for these small particle aerosols, which is what is referred as airborne transmission. And these are transmitted further than 6 feet away, potentially around a corner, especially in poorly ventilated indoor spaces. And then finally, there's a yet even more minor role, probably, for transmission via feces. So nothing new here.
Well, what do you make of this unremarkable guidance being published and then withdrawn?
Confusing. So CDC is not perfect and certainly has made some mistakes this past year. But with due respect to the agency, it's hard to imagine that this is one of them, given the scrutiny that they've had in all of their messaging. And for example, so just last week, we saw a flip-flop from CDC on testing of asymptomatic persons. We saw documented proof of manipulation of CDC's official publication. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not hard to understand people questioning that these changes may be deliberate interference by the Ministry of Obfuscation and Misdirection.
Which, of course, is not an official government office, but I gather you're suggesting the Trump administration is not happy with what the CDC is saying and is encouraging it to change things?
Well, we've seen the deliberate undermining of public health over the course of this outbreak for political purpose. And we have seen numerous examples now of deliberate change of guidance that's not evidence-based.
Can we still trust what the CDC tells us then?
Unfortunately, it's becoming harder to trust what CDC tells us. And this is extremely unfortunate because trust is the most important thing we need during a pandemic, as we tell people that regardless of this minor role of aerosol transmission, we have the tools available to us today to stop this outbreak in its track with test, trace, and isolate. And please do our part of wearing a mask, washing our hands, and socially distancing. And this trust is going to be even more important as we tell people to roll up their sleeves and get vaccinated, hopefully sometime at the end of this year and into next year.
I'm glad you mentioned things like masking. I want to know if the practical advice after all of this confusion is still basically the same so far as you see it. See people outdoors rather than indoors, 6 feet apart, wear a mask, that sort of thing.
Correct. The guidance doesn't change. So there's lots of nice, sophisticated aerobiology studies now that look at what happens when you sneeze and cough and how far these particles go and whether there's virus riding along in them. But we know that if we wear our masks and we couple that with the public health strategy of testing, isolating, and tracing people, that we can get this disease under control. And actually, many countries have done so, and some have even eliminated it, like, you know, Taiwan and New Zealand and China.
Dr. Ali Khan, University of Nebraska, thanks.
Thank you.
Our next two reports are related to the care and treatment of patients who are suffering from COVID-19. Our first article or report will be advances in ICU care that are saving more patients who have COVID-19. And then after that, COVID-19 medications are in development, but a true cure would likely take years.
Now to the pandemic. Despite the grim number in this country of people who have lost their lives to COVID-19, doctors have made big strides in figuring out how to keep people alive in the intensive care unit. NPR science correspondent Richard Harris tells the story of one man's remarkable recovery.
In early August, Don Ramsayer was helping his son pack up the car for his freshman year at the Citadel, the Military College of South Carolina. Ramsayer wasn't feeling that well, but he tried to play it down.
Got him ready, got the last box packed, everything was ready to go in the car, and I finally succumbed to my sister and my kids saying, "Dad, something's wrong. Go to the hospital."
Ramsayer, who's 59, had been diagnosed in November with a slow-moving form of leukemia. But the doctors at Emory Johns Creek Hospital, northeast of Atlanta, ran a few tests and concluded that his new symptoms were due to COVID-19. He got sicker and sicker over the weekend, and Ramsayer recalls the doctors called his sister with the sobering news.
Because they did not think I was going to make it. During this period of time, they basically started throwing everything in the kitchen sink at me, almost like Sherlock Holmes. What can we try here? What can we try there? Try to, you know, get in front of these things.
Among other measures, Ramsayer was treated with steroids, which have recently been shown to save the lives of some seriously ill COVID-19 patients. He got the antiviral drug remdesivir, as well as an experimental treatment called convalescent plasma. He also ended up on a ventilator for 9 days under heavy sedation.
Somehow, I got out of the straps. I completely unhooked myself and completely excavated myself and pulled the breathing tube out. And then here's the really funny thing is I'm really obviously pretty doped up. I mean, they had me all kinds of stuff and how I was even conscious. They're not even sure of that. The first thing I do, I said, can I have a Coke?
Happily, doctors realized that Ramsayer could get along okay without the breathing tube.
I continued to improve from that point forward.
Ramsayer's story is remarkable considering his cancer and the many complications of his case. But Dr. Craig Coopersmith, director of Emory's Critical Care Center, says this story is far from unique.
We have very much replicated what has been seen worldwide, which is over time mortality in the ICUs have decreased.
The decline in mortality varies month to month, but at Emory's hospitals, it has been in the range of 20 to 50%. Coopersmith says there's lots of reasons for that. A big one is that when the first wave of COVID-19 hit Atlanta's hospitals in April, doctors had no experience with the disease. Medical management of these patients is now, by comparison, routine.
There's certainly nothing routine about the pandemic, but in terms of how we're managing it, once you're taking care of something for the 10th time, it is normal.
Doctors can better manage common and serious complications like blood clots. They realize that patients do better if they aren't lying on their backs all the time. And a series of studies showed that steroids can save lives.
And so that's a tremendous success story. And in just a few months, we have a drug which is easily available everywhere and quite cheap that improves survival significantly in the ICU patient population.
Science has rapidly been brought to bear. But Coopersmith says it also helps that for the past 6 months, the ICU physicians at the five Emory hospitals have shared their personal experiences and ideas with one another in a daily text chat.
And in that, we find the art of medicine.
Patient Don Ramsayer adds to the list his own deep faith in God for getting him through the ordeal. After more than 6 weeks in the hospital, he's finally getting ready to go.
I'm walking, sitting, I can get around. My only limitation is just my oxygen requirement.
He's eager to return to his job as a software designer and to keep working with his doctors to figure out the right treatment for his leukemia.
That's something we'll tackle once I get back on my feet.
Richard Harris, NPR News.
So to stop the coronavirus pandemic, a vaccine is almost certainly necessary. But what about drugs for treatment? Though it's likely no single drug will be as effective as a good vaccine, there is a huge effort underway to develop effective medications. NPR science correspondent Richard Harris reports.
So far, scientists have only identified one kind of drug that is shown to save lives. Steroids help, a bit. They somewhat reduce the risk of death among seriously ill patients. It's a start. The drug remdesivir apparently shortens hospital stays. And this week, Eli Lilly said it is making progress on two more drugs, including one that is designed to block infection. Dr. Dan Skovronsky, Lilly's chief scientific officer, says the drug is derived from an individual COVID survivor's natural immunity.
We found the one antibody in their body that was the most potent. We engineered it in our laboratories, turned it into a medicine, made it in our factories, and started testing in patients.
This proof-of-concept study suggests that the strategy of blocking virus with antibodies holds promise, at least. Inma Hernandez at the University of Pittsburgh School of Pharmacy is hopeful, but she doubts that these drugs will be a game-changer.
These drugs are so complex to produce, probably we will not have antibodies available for treating everybody that gets coronavirus. They are probably also going to be considerably expensive.
Antibodies as a class are among the highest priced drugs. And Derek Lowe, a drug developer and industry blogger, notes that Lilly used hefty doses of these expensive drugs, grams of the stuff. Imagine making enough to treat the tens of thousands of Americans who get sick every day.
Those are truckloads of antibody.
Lots of drug companies are trying another approach to treating coronavirus. They're trying to find drugs that help tamp down the body's overactive immune system, since that reaction, inflammation, is dangerous and potentially deadly.
Problem is, inflammation and the immune system are so just ridiculously complicated that you have to be empirical. You have to say, well, that looks like a good idea. Let's go find out if it's real. And a lot of the times it's not.
That eats up time and money. Now, there are a few actual cures for viral diseases, including hepatitis C. Lowe says the secret there was to find just the right combination of drugs.
If you wanted to do that for the coronavirus, you would still be looking at quite a few years.
The reality is that most ideas that look great on paper actually fail somewhere along the way. They are either too toxic or they simply don't work. Dr. Vinay Prasad, a cancer doctor at UC San Francisco, says most of the time when a drug does work, it is rarely revolutionary.
Most of our effect sizes are modest benefits, 5% benefits, 2% benefits, 1% benefits.
When those drugs are combined, the benefits can add up, sometimes to quite effective therapies. But that takes years of trial and error. Prasad uses a baseball analogy for how he thinks coronavirus drug development might play out.
It's possible that we're going to get sort of singles and doubles. We might not get the home run, and we might have to rely on the core things that we know control viral spread.
Masks and social distancing are, in the short run at least, more potent than pills. Skovronsky at Lilly isn't discouraged, though. He says a cure usually doesn't require any medicine.
The truth is that for most people who get COVID-19, probably they cure themselves.
That's why his company is focusing on drugs that will help the 5 or 10% who get really sick. True, a lot of those drugs, like the antibodies, are expensive, but Skovronsky doesn't see that as an impediment.
We're confident that this will be an affordable drug for society and for governments. Of course, our expectation is that governments would not pass any expenses along to patients.
That's a big assumption, but with coronavirus, it seems all bets are off. Richard Harris, NPR News.
We've read and brought you a few reports over the past few months related to dentistry, oral care, taking care of your teeth. Here's another one of those. Doctors are seeing an uptick in teeth issues during the pandemic.
Okay, if there is one thing we have all felt during this pandemic, working from home, going to school from home, it's the stress, right?
I know I've been feeling it. And when I say feeling it, I mean it. My neck, my right shoulder, my back, mix in lousy ergonomics, and it's not great.
Yeah, same here. And apparently, those are not the only body parts that are suffering from our increased time at home.
Every day we've been getting emergency calls or patients coming in saying, I broke a tooth, my jaw hurts, not knowing what was wrong.
That's New York-based prosthodontist Tammy Chen. Her line of dentistry specializes in issues with jaws and tooth repair.
In a piece in the New York Times last week, Dr. Chen said her patients began experiencing all kinds of tooth damage as soon as lockdown started.
I've been seeing an uptick in broken teeth, broken restorations, increase in dental pain, really because people are stressed out.
She says clenching your jaw, grinding your teeth, it's a natural response to the stresses we've been put under because of COVID lockdowns.
Think about a time when your boss was asking you to do something you didn't want to do, or you were really frustrated with a child and trying to not scream and yell at them. An inherent response is to kind of grit your teeth together. So as a result to this anxiety, we're just seeing so much more clenching and grinding. People just kind of gritting their teeth together, trying to like grin and bear it and trying to get through this as best as they can.
One thing Dr. Chen recommends, simple awareness, checking in on yourself to make sure your mouth isn't clenched up throughout the day.
Our teeth shouldn't touch throughout the days. Our lips should be closed. With our lips closed, there should be enough space where you can stick the tip of your tongue in between your back teeth without having to move your jaw.
Another bit of advice for your cracked teeth or potential TMJ is to think about other parts of your body. Dr. Chen says we need to remember to get out of our home offices or our home office bedrooms every now and then. Even just go on a walk to give your back a break because everything is interconnected.
It breaks up the day and it allows your spine and your body to decompress with movement. Now with us at home, if we have a question, we simply email a colleague. We tend to sit in one seat for way too long. And as a result, everything just kind of slowly compresses upon itself.
Mm-hmm. So here's to the new normal, and hopefully a less stressful one at that.
And one in which your teeth will last you well into your later years.
Now two reports related to frontline workers. The first, how loss of health care workers in pandemic affects profession. And after that, emergency doctor on how her work has changed during the pandemic.
The number feels as stunning as it does inevitable. Within days, the United States will surpass 200,000 deaths from COVID-19. According to independent tracking from Kaiser Health News and The Guardian, nearly 1,200 of those who died were healthcare workers. Many were helping patients who were infected with the coronavirus. Christopher Fries is a professor of nursing at the University of Michigan and a registered nurse himself. He says it takes an enormous toll to tend to and maybe lose the very people you worked with.
Our professionals are weary. We are tired. And that is going to have downstream implications.
Those implications go way beyond just losing manpower. For one, Free says that these deaths fit existing inequities in American healthcare.
Environments with fewer resources, places like nursing homes, prisons, they usually don't carry the kind of protective equipment that we need in this pandemic. Those workers were particularly hard hit, and many of those workers are of color and work in disadvantaged areas.
And I can't imagine trying to care for people who you've actually worked with, right? I mean, is that a scenario that can happen here?
Right. Some of the early reporting from New York in particular included stories of fallen team members having to be cared for by their own team. ICU nurses now admitted to their own ICU, their own colleagues having to resuscitate them, revive them, and in some cases call their family members to say goodbye. And I've had, unfortunately, that circumstance caring for colleagues before in a different circumstance, and it's very difficult. It's very emotional, and it's hard work.
I know in many hospitals or other facilities, they're reusing protective equipment, right? Stuff that should have been one-time use or would have been considered one-time use in the past.
Right. So let's be really clear about this. Despite a lot of messaging, there is an acute shortage of high-quality personal protective equipment in the U.S. healthcare system today. And that's astonishing. And we have to look and wonder why we're still doing this 7 to 8 months in and what we could be doing differently to make sure that supply of personal protective equipment is there as we enter the flu season.
One thing we're trying to understand is how this loss, these deaths and the loss of expertise, right, affects the care that patients receive.
Right. So the loss of these senior expert healthcare workers can't be replaced in short order. And when we have less experienced healthcare workers at the bedside, that has huge implications across our sector. I also worry that the loss of experts at the bedside will make it harder to train the next generation of healthcare professionals, those in training. And then I also worry that this long-term depletion of our healthcare workforce will only exacerbate the weariness that I'm seeing in my colleagues today.
And I can't imagine it helps when it comes to recruitment and drawing new people in.
I think that's something we'll need to monitor carefully. I worry about students and aspiring students who may have thought healthcare was the right field for them, who might be rethinking those decisions as they see how our nation has protected or not protected our healthcare workers.
Early in the kind of quarantine shutdowns here in the U.S., there was a lot of kind of rhetoric praising healthcare workers, which no doubt was sincere, but you would have these kind of like a moment of silence or a moment of applause, you know, outside of your house or apartment. Is that kind of thing still going on, or do people feel kind of forgotten as the pandemic has dragged on?
So I appreciate our community's response, and I think my colleagues do as well. It's been really heartening to see that level of attention and care. I do admit sheepishly having an extra hour in the grocery store for healthcare workers is a rare treat, but I think what we would really like is adequate personal protective equipment. We would like our public health professionals to speak with one voice consistently on what the U.S. population should be doing to keep themselves safe and healthy. I think we'd rather have that than some of the other accolades that we've seen. We're here to take care of patients, and that's what we want to do, and we want to get people well first and foremost.
Christopher Fries, thank you so much for talking with us and sharing this story. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Audie.
That's Christopher Fries, professor of nursing and health management at the University of Michigan.
Just get ready. it's going to be bad. Well, those are the words of emergency room doctor Sachita Shaw from when we first interviewed her back in March. Dr. Shaw works at Seattle's Harborview Medical Center. In March, they had enough ventilators, barely. They had enough masks, but they were having to reuse them over and over. Shaw told us, quote, "It feels like being in battle without armor." Well, with the death toll in the U.S. now about to hit 200,000 people, we wanted to circle back to Dr. Shaw and see how things are going. Hey there, welcome back.
Thank you.
How are things going? How's the situation in your hospital, in your ER today, compared to where you were this past spring?
Well, COVID and caring for COVID patients has become sort of just part of our new life. We have a whole section of our emergency department that's now dedicated to taking care of patients with flu-like illness and ruling them out for COVID, or, you know, known COVID patients who are coming back and getting sicker, and donning and doffing our protective equipment and how to reuse it appropriately is becoming routine. I think our numbers in Washington state are improving, but obviously nationally and worldwide, it's a complete disaster.
You know, it's both stunning and I guess entirely to be expected to hear you describe the situation with COVID-19 as routine, as you've gotten used to it. Y'all are figuring it out.
Yeah, the thing that I worry about and the thing that's most different is healthcare worker resilience. You know, we're strong. We train in emergency medicine. For this, we serve as witness to all the tragedy of the community working in a trauma center. We're the canaries in the mine of public health. And so when there's a contagion or a public health disaster, we're sounding the alarm bells. And normally spring in a trauma center is kind of our chill season. We get to stop taking care of flu patients and get ready to get our new interns and get ready for trauma season, which is what we call summer. And this spring was really busy. And then this summer, we've had a very busy trauma season with more penetrating trauma and gun violence. And then August and September, which are traditionally beautiful months in Seattle, have turned into smoke and fire season. So we've had some pretty horrific cases, being a regional burn center for adults and children. So I've seen a lot over the past 6 months, and I just worry that, like, 2020 can't keep going like this.
Yeah. Before we move on from that, the air quality in Seattle has been horrific because of the smoke from the wildfires. I mean, aside from just presenting more patients, does that complicate your work with COVID patients?
Actually, so everybody started coughing and having sore throats and red eyes. Unfortunately, those are also symptoms of COVID. So we had a lot of patients come in for testing, which I think it's great to test everybody, but we did have kind of an influx of people requiring testing because the symptoms are so similar.
How are y'all doing on supplies? When we talked to you in the spring, as I mentioned, you had enough ventilators, you had enough beds, you had enough masks, but you were with masks, you told us you were wiping them down and reusing them because you didn't have enough to wear a fresh one with every shift. How are you doing on that front?
We are still going through a process to reuse our N95s. We don't wipe them ourselves. Now the hospital is taking care of repurposing them, and then we use them a few times and then they get discarded. And we have moved to a universal masking policy, which has been great because most of my patients that have had COVID positive tests have recently been asymptomatic, come in with another complaint, and we're approaching everybody now with a mask and face shield and gloves so that we are protected even if our patients are asymptomatic and wandering about the world and then come in with a different complaint but have COVID.
Right.
So that feels safer. I feel like we have armor.
What about the plan for the overlap of what's expected to be, you know, yet more COVID cases and the flu season upon us?
Yeah, that is what is weighing on literally everybody's mind right now in healthcare, is if people can get vaccinated for the flu, if they were on the fence, this is the year to do it because it's pretty impossible to distinguish the symptoms from one another. And testing for both takes hours upon hours, and it really does change our ability to have any flow through our emergency department because the patients can't go anywhere until we know if they have the flu or COVID.
Well, Dr. Shaw, thank you once again for taking the time to talk to us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That is Sachita Shaw. We've been checking in with her every few months as this pandemic has unfolded. She's an emergency physician at Harborview Medical Center in Seattle.
Now we're going to bring you two reports related to caring for the elderly. First, this report from Texas Standard. Texas elder care visitation rules relaxed. Following will be from NPR, how to care for older people in the pandemic.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Families with loved ones in elder care facilities have been hit doubly hard by COVID-19. Older people are more susceptible to the deadly virus, as we've heard, but strict visiting guidelines imposed on nursing homes and assisted living facilities has meant those kept inside could not visit with their loved ones, at least in person. The Texas Tribune reports that starting this Thursday, however, visitors will be allowed back even if there are confirmed COVID-19 cases at the facilities. Here to tell us more about these new guidelines and how his group is responding, Brian Lee, Executive Director of Nursing Home Advocacy Nonprofit Families for Better Care. Brian, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you, Dave. It's good to be here.
A little bit of history here. In March, Texas elder care facilities began barring visitors, right?
That's correct. Yes. As soon as the pandemic came on, states and the feds put nursing homes and assisted living facilities and other kind of long-term care settings on an immediate lockdown to essentially, you know, from a pragmatic standpoint, keep the virus out of facilities.
All right. So then you had a change in August. Some visitors were allowed if there were no confirmed COVID-19 cases among residents and no confirmed cases among staff members for 2 weeks straight. What do you know about the changes that take effect or are supposed to take effect this week?
Yeah, I think Governor Abbott, he is listening to families. I think there's a lot of anger and angst out there among families to see their loved ones. It was getting pretty restless. But I think he's being done a little bit of haste in some regard because there aren't enough precautionary measures to keep people safe. And in our opinion, I think it was the same week that the White House Commission on COVID and nursing homes came out with a report that said that testing is such an essential aspect of visitation and also just testing in facilities on a regular basis of staff and residents. And there's just not enough testing in nursing homes, and it's still not there.
That's my question. I mean, how much has really changed from where we were in August inside nursing homes and assisted living facilities?
Really nothing at all. In fact, what's being rolled out by Governor Abbott now, it could have been done months ago if there was this much concern about getting families back in to see their loved ones because of the isolation, depression, despair, just the normal day-to-day care issues. What Governor Abbott put out there could have been done a long time ago. And what's not included in his rollout is a good testing component. In fact, I think there's 14 days. If you have an initial visit to a nursing home, these new standards that he's put out, you have to have a test 14 days prior to that initial visit, whereas the feds are coming out saying now that there should be a recommended standard 48 hours prior to a visit. There's somebody should be tested.
I just want to be clear now. So if that kind of structure is not in place, what precautions should Texas be taking before they allow families to reunite in some of these facilities? Or what are other states doing?
Well, there's some essential standards, I think, that Texas is following that other states are practicing as well, and that is that the proper donning and doffing of PPE, some training on how to do that for families when they come into the building, the scheduling of visits. There's indoor visitation, there's outdoor visitation, limited access in the facility itself, some touching by what's called essential caregivers, people who are designated to actually go see their loved one and actually to interact with them. That's a good thing, is having those people that can interact and advocate for their loved ones who are living there. They can hug them, they can touch them, and that's part of this rule/standard that Governor Abbott's put out.
What do you tell, then, a family that wants desperately to get back and hug a loved one inside one of these facilities, knowing, though, that there isn't a testing regimen that is going to make a difference and that this could be another hot spot where their relative is? What do you tell that family member?
What I tell families, because they call us all the time about this, is that work with a nursing home, know what their policy is, ask them for that policy, and help them to get you back in there in a safe manner so that other folks are protected, and ask them what is their testing policy. We've even recommended to folks volunteer to go get a test done before you even go, just so that there is really caution. I think we've gone this far, this long, and I think we've tried to get this virus out of facilities. I think more foot traffic into it and throwing caution into the wind is going to just see a surge in cases and a surge in deaths.
Brian Lee is executive director of the nursing home advocacy nonprofit Families for Better Care. Brian, thanks again.
David, thank you, and have a good day.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard.
We know that older people are especially vulnerable to COVID-19. And from the beginning, the message from public health experts has been keep them safe, often by isolating them. That has not been good for many people's mental health. So how can we keep older folks both safe and happy? NPR's Malika Gharib asked a relative.
So I wanted to do this story because I was worried about my grandma, who I call Nanay, Tagalog for mother. Her name is Felisa Mersenne, a Filipino-American immigrant. She is 92, lives in Southern California, and is proud to say she was born on
January 30, 1928.
Nanay moved to the States in the 1980s after she retired as a professor in the Philippines. She's usually a sassy, independent lady, but when the pandemic hit, she was really scared.
Malika, I'm so afraid because, as I have read, number one risk is senior citizen.
Since I was a little girl, Nanay lived with my aunt, Tita Pinky. Tita Pinky's house is like the center of family activity. Relatives would come and eat and hang out, and Nanay loved it. But Tita Pinky is a doctor, and when the pandemic came along, she started leading her hospital's COVID response. Suddenly, we were all afraid of Nanay getting sick, so we decided it would be safer if she moved in with my uncle in order to isolate her from the possibility of getting COVID. But Nanay didn't want to move.
Because of my garden, I do not want to go away because of my flowers.
So, was it a good idea for our family to move Nanay? Sylvia Perel-Levin is with the International Network for the Prevention of Elder Abuse at the UN. I asked her what she thought.
You have said we have isolated our grandmother, instead of saying my grandmother chose to isolate herself. I would say that the first mistake was to make a decision for her.
Oh no, did we really not consider Nanay's feelings? Perel-Levin says there's some common assumptions that younger people make about older people, that they're helpless, that they might have dementia. But she says that's wrong.
Just think if it were you. Would you like somebody to do this to you?
It turns out Nanay actually did have a choice. Kind of. My uncles eventually gave her an ultimatum. Do you want the flowers or do you want your health? So Nanay packed enough clothes for a week and moved in with my uncle, Tito Ovid. He's got an extra bedroom, a swimming pool, and a nice big garden. But as the weeks rolled by, I wondered, was Nanay happy there? Perel-Levin says, if you want to know, all you have to do is ask. Well, I do ask, I think. I usually get an, I'm okay, but Perel-Levin wants me to dig deeper and listen, so I did. And Nanay told me that Tito Ovid and his wife treat her
like a princess.
Like a princess. Well, that's good. I waited a beat, and then Nanay said something else.
You know, Malika, to tell you the truth, sometimes I cry alone. Because I long for my room, I long for my flowers, I long for the surrounding.
This broke my heart. Alicia Del Prado is a Filipino-American psychologist. She says that Filipinos come from a family-centric culture, and when they have to split up, it's really painful.
Filipino families in general really show a lot of their love and connection just by physically being together.
And these days, Filipinos have to separate more because so many of them, like my aunt, they work in a risky field, healthcare. In California, where my family lives, a fifth of the state's nurses, for example, are Filipino.
What happens then when you can't see the people that kind of keep you sane, so to speak, that keep you feeling yourself?
Thankfully, my family has found a way to stay connected. They drop by with food and call Nanay often. But I wondered, how else could I, 3,000 miles away from my grandmother, possibly help? Betty Ann Moskowitz is the author of Finishing Up on Aging and Ageism, and she is 80 years old. She suggested I say,
Grandma, I know you're not happy here. And I get it. What could you do to make it better for you if you were going to stay? How can we help?
But before I could ask Nanay these questions, she figured out how to help herself.
I had no choice.
She had to do something, she says, so she will not be bored. So she sprung into action. She asked Tito Ovid to go to the store and buy her some flowers. Nanay had decided to grow herself a new garden because, she realized, she wouldn't be going home anytime soon. Malika Gharib, NPR News, Washington.
For our final story today, this one I'm going to read. It's from NPR and relates to the previous story. Reader Tips, 9 Ways to Bring Joy and Care to Older People in the Pandemic by Malaka Garib. After I shared my family's experience in trying to care for my 92-year-old grandmother in the pandemic, I wanted to know, how do we help older people feel safe and comfortable and happy in these times? I asked because I worried that my grandma, whom I call Nana, tag-along for mother, was feeling lonely and isolated in the pandemic. So I asked 3 experts to share some advice on how to help, and I invited readers to share their tips too. Dozens of readers wrote in. One piece of advice I took to heart, don't think of older people as a problem you have to solve. Here are some of my favorites from reader submissions. I can't wait to try them with Nene. 1. Stay in touch. Keep older relatives in the loop. Share your joys, discuss your sorrows, and ask their advice. Even if it is over the phone or by FaceTime, it makes us feel connected and relevant. Barbara Goodman. 2. Organize virtual dinner and TV time. I am 74 years old and live alone, yet every day I schedule virtual dinner meeting time with my remote family on Facebook Instant Messenger. After dinner, we watch and share the same TV programs for 1 hour. Ironically, the required COVID-19 physical distance from my family has resulted in a much closer and stronger emotional and spiritual bond. Dennis. 3. A good reminder. Stop treating older people like they are a problem to be solved. Pat Gaidos. 4. Figure out ways to connect them to their interests. My mom is 92 and her eyesight is affected by macular degeneration. Because of this condition, she cannot see well enough to read. I asked her if she would like to listen to recorded books and she said yes. I went to public libraries and found fiction based on the Depression era, when she was a child, and checked them out for her. I also purchased a simple CD player and wrote in large letters directions so that she could start and pause the CD herself. My mom is enjoying the stories immensely. Bernadette Potts. 5. Send a weekly postcard. My brother sent a postcard to our mom once a week with a message that told her what he was doing, such as, ate apple pie for dessert tonight, or took the dog to the vet for his annual checkup, or saw this building today. Simple things like that. He did this for 60 years. Isn't that wonderful? Lisa Simon. 6. Use their skills. Let us know how we can help. We are old, but not dead. We have lots of skills. We can sew masks, make lunches for emergency workers, make family a meal. Christine Gagon. 7. Go for a pleasant drive or walk. My wife is 75 with fairly advanced Parkinson's, requiring virtually 24-hour care by me. I'm 73. We are healthy and active, other than the challenges of her disease. We're both pretty bored. Here are a couple of things we do. We go for car rides. The car is essentially an extension of the home safety bubble. We go frequently for an hour or so. We also go on longer trips to the shore, about an hour away. We found some places with great views of the ocean from the car. We bring a picnic lunch, which is eaten in the car, sometimes followed by a brief snooze in a safe parking lot. We're lucky to live in a neighborhood where there are few cars. I push her in her wheelchair for walks. Nice change of scenery for her and good exercise for me. We go late in the afternoon when it's cooler and there is still plenty of light. Roger Bentley. 8. Be patient. As a new caregiver for my father, I encountered a few situations that bothered me, such as my father asking me the same question dozens of times. My advice: when he mentions or asks something for the umpteenth time, don't show exasperation. Treat it like you're an actor on a movie set. Your character is compassionate, patient, funny, and doesn't get upset or excited. So pretend each repeat is simply another take on the same scene for the movie. Try your best to give an Oscar-winning performance every time. Bob Chance. 9. Create a custom lesson plan. My sister had a brilliant idea, and I will say it has made a significant improvement in our dad's happiness factor. My sister was a teacher and educator for many years and was skilled at developing challenging and fun lesson plans. So she used our family history information as core curriculum and built a lesson plan for 4 days a week for my dad, which he does via email. A lesson plan example is, one arm of our family migrated to the U.S. in the 1800s via Tasmania, Australia, and New Zealand. My sister sends me an email about one of those relatives and ties that to a geographical lesson about where they lived at the time. The total lesson plan is on average an hour a day. If Dad is not up to doing the lesson, he can pass and then take it up on another day. As follow-up, our caregiver or I can bring up the topic and initiate a conversation about the topic. My sister also uses it as a conversation topic for the daily phone calls she makes to my dad. Jerry Waite. And that is your coronavirus update for this Tuesday, September 22nd, 2020. I'm Michael from the Recording Library of West Texas. Coming up at 2 o'clock, we'll bring you the national news from USA Today. At 3 o'clock, our local news. Here's some of the articles that our volunteers will be reading from the newspapers. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, NAACP says any name with Lee is offensive. MISD's interim leader is known for quickly identifying problems. Business is back. Midland bars jump through hurdles to reopen. Reporter-Telegram rewards subscribers with insider content. From the Odessa American, two teens recovering following wreck. Three other teens were killed during the tragic accident. Council to vote on Odessa Public Facility Corporation. County tax vote is today. Taxes will increase for most in Ector County. OC to hold tax rate hearing. Those stories and more from our local volunteer readers at 3 o'clock this afternoon. And then, of course, at 6 o'clock, we'll bring you more international, national, and business news from the Wall Street Journal. Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American at 3. Each week, hear an hour of informative news and reports. First, it's the AARP Report, with readings from AARP Magazine and the AARP Bulletin. AARP publications cover stories that include health, lifestyle, celebrity biographies, and senior employment issues. Then it's diabetic news, with readings from Diabetes Magazine, Diabetes Self-Management, and more. Hear the hour-long block of the AARP Report and Diabetic News, Thursdays at 4 a.m. and 10 a.m., and Sundays at 6 p.m. from Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 79 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-60s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-80s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
This is Sister Eileen Bielman reporting for the USA Today, Tuesday, September 22nd, 2020. U.S. Supreme Court. Ginsburg to lie in state at the U.S. Capitol on Friday. She will be the first woman in history so honored. Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg will lie in state at the U.S. Capitol on Friday, becoming the first woman in history so honored. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced Monday that Ginsburg's casket would be placed in National Statuary Hall, where a formal ceremony will be held for invited guests only. A separate ceremony will be Wednesday morning at the Supreme Court for Ginsburg's family, close friends, and members of the court. The public then will